Welcome to Minnesota Stories. I'm your host, Tyler Coleman. Today, I'm speaking with Joel Tyson. Now, Joel's story that we're going to talk about is of the founding of a law school. But imagine being part of a founding class where you're attending classes hoping to get a degree in law before the school's actually accredited to give those degrees. That's Joel's story. The original class of Hamline Law School started out not knowing whether their degree at the end would allow them to be lawyers in the state of Minnesota. It's a fascinating story, and we're glad that he's been willing to share that with us today. So enjoy Joel Tyson's Minnesota story. Joel, thank you very much for joining us on Minnesota Stories. We've talked in the past, and your stories are varied and interesting and span a little bit of time now. But let's start off at the very start. Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. Lived in the city during the winter months and then on a farm in the summertime. And how that happened was my grandfather, who was born in 1875, today he'd be about 146, lived in a small town outside of Fond du Lac on a farm, which he hated farming. And he was a very smart guy, so he got to go what, at the time they would call in Europe university, it was really just high school. So he went from the farm, a grade school, to this high school in Fond du Lac, 17 miles away. And he was so smart, he ended up leaving there and graduating and going to medical school at Rush Medical in Chicago. And he was in the class of 1900. In fact, I have his license on my wall at our cabin. He then came back to Doddyville, this little bitty town out in the country. And his parents were very poor. His mother bought him a horse with a buggy so he could do his rounds. He had an office above a bar because there were no such thing as offices. His very first patient was some guy in the bar wanted him to pull his tooth, which he did. But he officed out there and he'd do his rounds with his horse and buggy that had all the reins on it to get rid of the flies. I have a picture of that. It's pretty cool. Then he ended up moving to Fond du Lac and opened an office. And believe it or not, after not too many years, he decided he missed farming. So he bought a farm. And he hired people to run it, and he'd go out there at about 5 in the morning and tell them what to do for the day. And it had big Guernsey cows, which were high in butter fat. That was the big thing back then. And horses to pull all the implements. And he had sheep and pigs and, you know, the whole ball of wax. That farm was maybe 200 and some acres. Move forward many years, he ended up adding another farm. And then when my father married my mother, which was his only child, my dad bought a little farm, so they farmed at 500 and some acres.
That was huge at the time.
It was huge. And Grandpa would hire the hired hands, and he'd go out there in his three-piece suit, which he always wore, with high-buckle shoes, and he wore long underwear year-round, in the winter long underwear, in the summer long underwear, and he said that helped keep you cool, which I never realized. He was a really amazing, interesting person. So he would manage the farms and then run his medical practice. Ultimately, as I said, my dad, who interned with him, my dad went to Marquette, interned with my grandfather and married his only daughter, my grandfather's only daughter, Dorothy. And they then practiced together forever. Grandpa still would manage it until finally in his 80s, I think he turned it over to my mother to run. And she ran it until she died, and we still have a little of the land left we're attempting to sell right now at a reasonable price. But he died at age 98, and he was, like, totally together and healthy until about a year before he died. He fell and hurt himself, but he would, he still could talk to you about any subject matter that existed. He could talk to you about you being from Canada and everything he knew about Canada. And everybody was so impressed because he had this mild demeanor where he could get along with anybody. But I never knew until one time. I used to come home from college, and I'd first go to my grandpa's to tell him what time I'd pick him up the next day because he could no longer drive. And then we'd drive and talk. And one of the last times we took a ride, he kind of started to get a little moist in his eyes, and he said that I was one of the only people he could really talk to, that most people didn't realize it, but he was very shy. And so he and I really hit it off and had a wonderful relationship. And that's how I ended up being on the farm. When I turned 10, my dad had this farmhouse redone by one of his patients. It took about a year or two, and then we moved out there permanently. So that was the beginning.
So obviously they had a large, big influence on you. You come now from a short line, but a line of doctors. Your educational path ended up taking a whole lot of different directions. But I expect you started off in elementary school. Where did you attend secondary school?
Elementary school was at a Catholic school, which I never liked for many reasons. And if you want to know, I'll tell you some of them. Then I ended up going to a Catholic high school for 1 year and despised it. And ultimately told my father, who was so strict with us, so I can't tell you how strict, that if he wanted to put me in a reform school, he could do whatever he wanted, but I won't go back to that Catholic school. And so I ended up going to the public high school after that, and then I began to love school.
Okay.
Okay.
And so high school went fairly well.
Well.
What did you, because we're going to get to the law school part of things, which is fascinating to me. With the, after high school, where did you go? Did you take an undergraduate degree somewhere?
I went to a school, it was at the time the oldest school in the state of Wisconsin, called Milton College in a little bitty town. Milton, which is outside of Janesville, Wisconsin. I wanted to go to the University of Wisconsin, but at the time it was thought by some people to be too, literally, communist influence and socialistic. And so it was talked down, and plus...
So is this, like, by a number of people, but is it your parents?
No, not so much my parents, but this Monsignor that ran the parish I went to, who was a tyrant in some many ways. And plus my parents thought it was too big, and it was also had the reputation of one of the top party schools in the country, so they didn't want me to go there. So I went to this little private school called Milton College and graduated in 4 years, which you had to. At the time, if you didn't graduate in 4 years, you were automatically drafted because the Vietnam War was then.
Okay.
And there were other, it wasn't just graduating in 4 years, though. You had to keep grade at least a C level or better. And then at one point, it was no longer grades, it was grades plus you had to take a test and get a certain score or you might get drafted. In the last year of my school, you had a lottery number, and if your number was picked, you'd be drafted.
Okay. And how close were you to being drafted?
I got drafted, which is a very interesting story. I did not like the woman that ran the draft board because, and it wasn't me that didn't like her, it was everybody where I lived from Fond du Lac, because she would play with your classification from time to time. In other words, it was 2S, if I remember, was a deferment for school. And all of a sudden you get a new card in the mail and say you're 1A, and you go, well, how'd that happen? Which, if you were 1A, you could get drafted. And so that happened to me 2-3 times during my college career, and I always met the requirements so I should be able to stay in school. So I decided I wasn't going to let her touch me. So I went and joined the Air Force. I'd been trying to get into the Air National Guard, and I got a call one day that I was just accepted to the Air National Guard as long as I wasn't drafted. But my legal residence at the time was still Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, so I called my parents and I said, I haven't gotten any draft notice, have I? My mother said, yes, you got it today. So I no longer could go into the Air National Guard. So I went right down and joined the Air Force. And I was in the Air Force for, I forget, a few years. And they were letting people out early. Plus, I had migraine headaches and they were going to send me to Thailand, and they said, you wouldn't last there because of the heat. But, so I did get drafted, but she never touched me. But so she wanted to. But this, I got to tell you this. So I thought it was too weird. I joined the Air Force, and they made me wait like 2 months because Nixon was president. He started Vietnamization, the wind down, you know. So there were no schools open, or they were limited for the Air Force. So one day they called me in, and they said, if you get a job in, say, South Chicago or west part of Chicago or a poor area as a teacher, we have to tell you that we can't drag out your life any longer, and you can get an honorable discharge, and, you know, and you're out of the service because we've made you wait all this time. It sounded crazy to me. So I went and saw a lawyer who handled these types of matters, and he said, that's true. They have to let you out because they've made you wait too long, as long as the Air Force filed all the proper paperwork with the draft board. He said, call your draft board right now. I did, and Mrs. Undersack, who's the lady that was the, running the draft board, answered, and I told her who I was. She said, where are you? I'm sending the MPs out to pick you up. You were supposed to have reported to duty a month ago, and you never showed up. And I said, well, I'm in the Air Force. She said, they never told me. So I left that lawyer's office, went to the Air Force, and they apologized profusely. They said, we'll have you out of here soon. They called her, had the pickup order quashed, and within a week, I was on a plane to Lackland Air Force Base.
So if you would have gone home, you were probably going to get picked up by the military.
Probably. I mean, who
police.
Knows?
Yeah. Yeah. So you went to Lackland.
Lackland.
Lackland. This is me being a new American. And so what was your time there like?
Well, have you ever been in the service?
No.
Okay.
I'm from another country originally.
Yeah, I know, but I didn't know if they have mandatory service in Canada.
They don't.
They don't. It was, I mean, I met a lot of nice people. It was an experience that I could, it was 6 weeks of basic training. And I could make that a separate story, which I won't. But I was very glad when it was done. And again, because in Nixon's Vietnamization, they didn't have schools for us. So they moved most all of the recruits at the time to the other side. Lackland is a very big base. It's the only base, by the way, that the Air Force has for recruits, you know, when you go in for basic training. And where, they put us on the, it's in Texas, okay. Outside of San Antonio. They put us on the other side of the base, and they just gave us crazy jobs for each day, either KP. In fact, I remember doing KP for the soldiers from Iraq and
Iran. What
does Iran.
KP stand for?
Kitchen duty.
Oh, okay.
You would go there at 4 in the morning till like 6 in the afternoon and work like fools. But I remember we used to train these officers from Iran and Iraq, countries later that we had all these problems with. And or I might get assigned the day to clean officers' quarters or whatever. So I was there about a month or two waiting to get a job because there were so few jobs.
So you finished your time in the service, and did you go teach on the south side of Chicago?
No, because I got drafted.
Right.
It wouldn't work.
Okay. So it must have crossed your mind at some point of becoming a doctor.
Never.
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 Why is that?
Because two reasons. Number one, I'm no good at math or science, and you have to be good at those two areas. Number two, my dad, who was the old farm type of doctor, he very proud of the man, but all he did was work 7 days a week. And I don't mean 8 hours a day, mostly 15, 20 hours a day. He was always just operating on little sleep. And he was, you know, the old doctor, like I say, he charged very reasonable rates. And when the government got involved with Medicare, he told all of, and he had a great practice. I have one brother that wanted to do it almost, but he said, don't. The government's going to ruin this practice. And he always used to give me the example that at the time he was on the board or the staff, he could put you in the hospital by being on the staff of the hospital where we grew up. And it was $50 a night or something. Once the government got involved, because of all the paperwork and all of the people up and down the chain, that same room was $200-$300 a night. And he said, it's going to ruin the medical business because everything is going to get so expensive, people won't be able to afford it. And by God, he was pretty right on.
So you weren't going to go that route. What did you take for your undergrad when you went to college?
Sociology.
Okay.
I loved.
Was there an idea? Did you just take it for interest's sake, or did you have a career in mind?
Interest's sake, I think. And there was a, a, a professor by the name of Rhett Jones. He was an African-American man who was, like, amazingly impressive. And I heard he was a really good teacher. And I took the first class from him, and I took every class he had thereafter. And he was an amazing teacher and an amazing person. In fact, I called him after graduating and practicing law for a long time to tell him that I know for sure that he was instrumental in me having all the grit I had and doing what I did in life.
Hmm.
And he said, well, thank you. I never. He at the time, he was a professor at Brown University. And we talked for quite a long time. And then we exchanged correspondence, but he was ill and he must have died because I never heard from him again.
Okay. So sociology, and now you said you went into law. When I first heard your story, because I completed law school at the oldest law school in the Commonwealth. It was because back then they used to do apprenticeships, but when they established a law school in New Brunswick, and it was you sign up, you go for your 3 years, and then you go work in a law firm afterwards. It's a very standard set path once you're on it. Yours is completely different, and it's fascinating to me. So maybe start off with when you decided or had this inkling that you wanted to get into law.
Well, as I mentioned to you, I grew up on a farm, and we worked on that farm. And I did not want to go to college. I wanted to stay on the farm. And when I say we worked when we weren't in school during the school year, we worked probably 90 to 100 hours a week. And people go, how could that be? Well, if you remember, when you're milking cows, you start get up at 4:30 or 5, and you don't quit until about 8 at night. And you do that 6 days a week. And on Sunday, you just milk. But if crops have not gotten in, you might work all day Sunday, too. But my parents said, no, you have to go to college. Okay. Well, my grandfather, who was very instrumental in my whole life, taught me politics from a really young age on. And he got me really interested in it. And so I wanted to get into politics, and I felt the best way to do it was to go to law school, and that's the only reason I wanted to go to law school.
Okay. So after getting out of the military, or just as you were getting out, you decided to apply to law school then?
No, before that, when I was in the military, I called this Professor Jones, who I had, and I told him I wanted to go to law school. Did he know? Could he advise, you know, give me a letter of recommendation? Because in California, they have many more schools than in other states. In fact, they have schools that aren't accredited, and you can still, if you go to that school and graduate, you can still practice in California, which isn't what I wanted to do, but I wanted to go to school, and I got information about a school, and he was going to write a letter of recommendation, but then it went by its wayside because then I moved to another state in the service. So no, I didn't go to law school and then full-time until after I got out of the service in Chicago at a school called John Marshall School of Law.
Okay. And I know you started at John Marshall School of Law, but that's not
no,
where you finished. So what happened in that first year?
Okay. Well, we moved to Chicago after I got out of the service, and there were hardly any jobs, so I drove cab in the city of Chicago for the first months we lived there, and then
and you're saying we, so you got married at some point.
I was married. I got married to my wife of 49 years in 1970, and we had no children at the time we moved to Chicago. We had been together in the service. I knew my wife, by the way, for 3 months, and then we got engaged, and we got married 3 or 4 months later. So we moved to Chicago. I drove cab. She got a job as a secretary, and then I applied to John Marshall and got in. And I went to day classes for the first year and still drove cab some. And there were 80 in my section when I started there. And then I ended up the next year getting a job with the state of Illinois, giving driver's tests, and I did that from 8 in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. So then I went to night school at the law school for another year or year and a half. After going to school for about a year and a half or two, there were, out of my first 80, I think there were 12 of us left because it was very difficult to stay in this school. There were a lot of things going on that ultimately the ABA questioned because After I ended up leaving that school, they came in and put him on probation and made him get rid of their dean and registrar. And at this point, I won't go through all that went on, but it was some, the way that they were trying to create what a lot of us felt, the Harvard of the Midwest, making it very hard to graduate. In fact, I had a teacher in my first year, and since you're a lawyer, you remember this. The first class you take for torts is intentional torts. Was that what you had?
Sounds right.
And so you haven't had the negligence class yet, which is next semester. Well, we had a professor who had a review session for us, and the dean found out about it. So he got a hold of the exam and put a question on it for negligence that none of us knew the answer to because it was the next semester. So you started 20 points in the hole right out of the chutes. So after a year and a half, I decided, you know, I didn't want to be one of these people that the dean would just flunk out at the end, because he literally would call people in and say, even though you're passing everything, I don't think you're law school material, and he'd flunk you out. But most people flunked out just because of the courses, because every year you had to take comprehensives of all the classes you had the year before. So I applied to other schools and ultimately didn't go to any of those schools. I was accepted to two of them. The third one, I was accepted to all three of them now that I think of it. But decided instead to go, after going to a homecoming and running into a friend who'd gone to John Marshall, where I went in Chicago, he said a new school started in Minneapolis, and my wife came with me to Minneapolis, and we checked the school out, and that was in 1972.
So 1972 was the start of your story being in Minnesota.
Correct.
And maybe explain, because the school that we're talking about now is what's known now as Mitchell Hamlin.
Correct.
And, you know, there's a lot of very good lawyers that have attended law school at Hamlin University. But you were the class at the time, the first class at Hamlin University. What was it like when you got there? Because this was before it was even accredited, which in the state of Minnesota means if it's not accredited, you cannot write the bar. It's not like California, correct?
That's correct. Okay, so you have to back up a little.
Sure.
So my wife and I came and checked it out, and by then we had a baby who is now turned 47 yesterday. He was, I think, 6 months old or whatever, and we looked at each other, and we were not big risk takers, but we decided we're not getting any younger. So we looked at the school, and we thought, we'll take a chance. It was just getting going. It was called Metropolitan College of Law or something. They did not have accreditation, but allegedly they were headed to the moon and were going to do wonderful. So we decided
to. Was the school associated with a?
Nothing. It was all on its own. It was at the whole old, if you remember, the Horst building on LaSalle Street. It was Horst hairstyling for years, a big old beautiful castle right downtown Minneapolis. No, that's where the school was located. It was one man that had started it, and he had teachers teaching an entry class first year. So we got an apartment, and then we went back to Chicago and gave our notices for work and apartments and got a mover a month or two later and moved to Minnesota on December 31st, 1972, the worst snowstorm they'd had in years. We just made it, unpacked, and so the next day was New Year's Day. So I didn't go over to the school to tell them I was here. The second I went over there of January, and a fella met me at the door of the school, and he saw me open the door, and he pushed me out the door, and he said, "Don't come in." He said, "You're Joel Tyson, right?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I tried to call you in Chicago to tell you the school doesn't exist anymore." He said, "And we didn't want you to move." And that was before cell phones, okay? And my phone had been disconnected, our headline, so they couldn't get a hold of me. They said, "But if you're interested in starting your own law school, we're going to have a meeting deciding what to do at the Normandy Inn downtown Minneapolis this next Saturday. Come there with $5 for coffee in the room, and everybody will pay for it." And the dean, who has resigned here, by the way, and as have all the professors, and the reason the school went under is they found out the guy running it was not with the best intentions and probably was a crook. So the students and all the professors resigned, and the dean. So then I left the fella, who was Len Burnett, who ultimately was a teacher at the school and in our class, and I went looking for my wife. I couldn't find her or the baby. And of course, the worst things raced through your mind because something had just happened pretty crazy, that we moved here and no longer was there a purpose. And we were in what I thought was a decent neighborhood. People had grass in their lawns and garages, which was where we lived in Chicago. That wasn't necessarily the case. But she was gone. I couldn't find her. I finally found her. She was just walking around with the baby, and I told her what happened. And we went back to our apartment and talked about it and said, well, can you still get into John Marshall this semester? So I called, and they said yes. And we looked at each other and go, you know, we thought of our good friend who had a nervous breakdown because of that school and went back to the farm in Pecatonica, Illinois. And she said, well, why don't we go to that meeting? Or you go. I mean, it was just for the students. And I went. And this big burly man up there who was a professor at the school, but he had a criminal practice in Minneapolis, he said, you know, you just don't start a law school. He said, it's just not something you do overnight. So I suggest we meet every month for a year, and at the end of that year, if you all still want to start a law school, you know, I'll help you do it. And there were probably 50 people there at that meeting, maybe. I don't remember exactly. But he said, if you vote today to start a law school now, I'll be your dean, and I'll help you start the school. I have a friend that's got a drug methadone treatment center on the north side of Minneapolis who said we can meet there at night for 2 months. So we had a vote, and we voted to start a law school, and we did. And we were the laughingstock of the Twin Cities. All the newspapers made the fledgling law school students trying to start their own.
What did the class look like? Was it all different ages?
All different ages. I think there were two women or three, one black guy, the rest were Anglos of every cotton picking walk of life you can imagine. One guy owned a bread company. He just died a year ago at 93 or 4. Most everybody in that 33, which is what ended up starting the school, worked all day and then went to school at night. And what would happen is we'd start classes at night at 5:30 or 6. We'd have classes till 10, and then we'd have a meeting to determine what we were going to do next to try to move forward to build this school. And we started a trust that held our tuition, which was a minimal amount of money, and then trustees to the trust who kind of managed it, so it was all above water. And then we hired the dean, who still had his criminal practice, but he was our dean. And then two other professors, Harry H. Peterson, who was a past Supreme Court Justice of Minnesota and Attorney General, so he lent a lot of credibility. He was kind of people considered kind of a rebel rouser. He was one of the founders of the DFL party. He was with Floyd B. Olson, that's Highway 55, you know, Olson Memorial Highway in Minneapolis. He was governor, and Harry was his attorney general. And Harry and Declan and I became extremely good friends. He died at about 89 or 90. But so we would meet, and we finally built a board of trustees, and then we left the Drug Methadone Treatment Center, and we moved to the fourth floor of an old art gallery in Minneapolis across from the Minneapolis Art Institute. And that's where we met every night for a year. And then we'd have those meetings for a whole year.
So you're doing the meetings, and how long did this go on? How long did it take to get your degree, and how long did it take for the school to actually get accreditation and get some kind of a...
Well, after about maybe 3-4 months of the meetings, we invited people to be trustees and, you know, set up a board of trustees that had credibility within the state of Minnesota. So we were no longer the laughing stock of the city.
Sure.
I have a pamphlet with all these articles. You know, it was crazy what they wrote about us.
How many law schools were there at the time?
There was, I think, 3. Mitchell, University of Minnesota.
St. Thomas?
No. I guess there were just 2.
Okay.
And so we finally, the students just ended up working after a while and going to school, because the trustees ran it and hired the professors, even though we still had the final say-so, whether a professor would stay on board or not. You know, we still retained the control over the school as the original board. But after three, 4, 5 months, the dean took over, and people under him, and this Len Burnett who met me, he worked in the administration, and then they brought in a couple other people who worked for next to nothing, and then... we moved from that art gallery to the Raymar building on Franklin in Minneapolis, and we opened ourselves up to another class. And then the Burlington Northern Railroad donated about many thousands of books to our law library. And so then the students on weekends, we would travel around the United States to different law offices that would donate books. And we tried to build a library. And finally, the West Publishing, which is no longer called West, I can't think of the name right now, but they believed in us enough that they sold us $100,000 or something, law books for our library. And so we were starting to gain credibility because of the people on the board and because we took in a second class, and we were still going after everybody thought we'd fail. And this was year two of the school.
I just, thinking about it, you know, because of going through the application for law school process, and knowing some people who applied and didn't get in, I mean, the thought doesn't cross people's minds. It's, okay, did I get in? Did I get into the system? And if they don't, it's, oh, they're crushed my hopes and dreams or something like that. Nobody thinks, you know what we should do? We should get 30 of us together and just start one. It's just fascinating to me that you guys did this. And, you know, even when you're talking about people traveling around the world and asking for books, those books at that time was a huge expense. It's just a fascinating story. So you were getting the credibility, but at some point you needed to get accreditation so that you could actually write the bar. When did that happen?
Yeah, and to mention, we didn't go around the world to get books, around the United States.
Sure.
It was mostly the Midwest, but I mean, like, I remember one weekend myself and one other law student went to Chicago and rented a van. I remember we had 3 flat tires in the process and parked downtown by the Board of Trade in Chicago, and on the 30th or 40th floor of a law office, they had donated us all these books. Because, see, there were ads in different magazines that we were trying to build a library, and these lawyers would donate books. So that was year two. And then the dean, Dick Oakes, applied for accreditation, and we were turned down. And you're accredited through the American Bar Association. You go to their annual meeting, whatever, and you apply, and we were turned down. And he had gotten all of the requirements, which were, as he used to say, volumes of books. You had to comply with all of the regulations, and he felt he'd done everything we needed to do. We applied, I think, 2 more times after that and kept getting rejected. So he found out that probably the only way we were going to have much luck is if we affiliated with another institution. So he did research, people on the staff, and we ultimately affiliated with Hamline. Now, remember, the name of our school was Midwestern School of Law. That's what we named it, us 33 of us. Okay. We affiliated with Hamline University as a tenant, not a full affiliation. We moved onto the campus of Hamline University in my senior year, and in an old building there that they let us use. And by then we had 3 classes of students, and built up a relationship with them. And I will never forget this as long as I live. By then we'd become somewhat respectably thought of by the community, because we had a good board of trustees of some named people. We had 3 classes, and the articles in the paper were getting to be a little more, you know, congratulatory, I guess. But still, we did not have accreditation. So in February, and this may be wrong, of 1975, I believe, I think it was February, the dean went to Chicago, I think it was, to, again, put the pitch in. He'd applied for accreditation again. You get provisional, by the way, to start with, but you're fully accredited to graduate and take the bar. And Jim Nystrom, I think at the time, he was the president of our board of trustees. He had a big construction company in Minneapolis. They went to Chicago. But we had met with Dick before he went, and he said, I'll tell you what, if I don't get accreditation this time, we're going to have to give all of you incompletes, because even if you pass the classes, you can't graduate from an unaccredited school and take the bar in Minnesota. So just be prepared for that. So on the day he went, he had gone to Chicago, on the day, it was a Saturday, I believe, I had my first moot court trial, you know, where you're learning how to be a lawyer, and we had a trial. at the law school building in St. Paul, and we walked out of having that moot court trial, and somebody said, guess what? The dean just called and we got accreditation. So we were just so amazingly excited. We all went to the airport to greet him. And by then it was no longer just the 33, there were two other classes. And one of the students, because the euphoria, as you can imagine, was unbelievable, the excitement.
And well, it was 3 years of unknown.
Unknown, and exactly.
Dedicating and, 3 years of your life.
At the time in the United States, there were problems with hijacking of planes, okay? It wasn't talk of terrorists as much as just hijacking of planes, but. And one of the students, just jokingly, as we were going to the plane, because at that time you could walk into the airport and go to greet somebody coming out of a plane. He said, let's hijack a plane. And immediately somebody picked him up, and he was taken down to the Cusco on the lower level of the airport. So the minute Dick got off the plane with his wife and Jim Nystrom, and we congratulated him, we had to tell him that one of the students was just arrested and was down below in the airport. So he went and it straightened it out, and they understood that it was just the unbelievable euphoria, because we had all worked for 3 years, blood and guts, and you know it took a toll on everybody's life, as you can well imagine. And so then we went to somebody else's house, one of the classmates. In fact, it was Len Burnett, who was the guy that shoved me out the door and said, don't come in. And we partied all night long. It was unbelievable.
So you didn't have to get an incomplete? You were, the school was given accreditation, and then they had to write the bar. How did they do on the bar exam?
Did very good on the bar exam. There were 33 of us that graduated, and I don't think everybody took the bar. I think it was like 30, you know, that number may be wrong. And you take bar prep courses, which we did for 2 months in the summer, and we had a very high success rate. But I'll never forget the bar exam build up to it, because towards the end of the prep, I got sick and I had a high, high temperature. But if I didn't take that exam, I was going to have to wait 6 more months to take it. And remember, I was this oddball student that came all the way from Chicago, and I wasn't about to quit at this stage. So I went into that exam so sick, I can't tell you. And at the time, the exam was 2 days of written questions. There were no multiple choice or multiple guess or anything. And they were all essay. And once you took that exam, you didn't find out for, I believe, a month or 2 months that whether you passed it or not. So I'll never forget sitting for the morning part of the exam. And then you take a break at noon for a little bit, and then somebody would come up to you and say, what'd you think of that contract question? And I might go, that wasn't contracts, that was torts, you know. I mean, so everybody is so scared, and I'm more scared because I'm so sick. But long and short of it is we finished the exam. And I remember about a month and a half afterwards, the rumor mill would start, and people would start calling and say, I hear the results are coming out today. If it's a thick envelope, you passed. If it's a thin envelope, you didn't pass. So those rumors were just rumors, but one day a friend called up and said, I got the results and I passed. I jumped on my bicycle. It was before I had to go to work that day. At the time, I was a law clerk at the city attorney's office in Minneapolis. I got on my bike and I went looking for the postman, and I think he thought I was weird as could be, because I ran him down with my bike, and I said, can I please have my mail? And he gave me the mail, and it was a thick envelope.
And that was the start of a legal career that we could do a whole other interview on. We've kind of come up to our time, but that is just such a fascinating story. And to be able to say that you're one of the founding class, one of the founding members of a law school, it's not something a lot of people get to say, definitely not a lot of people who are still alive get to say. So Joel, thank you so much for sharing that story. We always ask the question at the end, who you think we should interview. I mean, with your background and your involvement in and around the Twin Cities, who are some people that you think we should interview for Minnesota Stories?
Well, a friend of mine, her name is Colleen LeBeau. Her father was a major developer. He died about a year and a half ago, who developed multiple condominiums and was quite a, let's say, a folk hero. But she has an amazing history and background, and success, what she's accomplished in life is absolutely amazing. Number two, a good friend of mine, his name is Skip Thaler, T-H-A-Y-L-E-R. He was from Wisconsin, but he went to, I think, St. Thomas and then entrepreneur school, and he was at one time one of the owners of Tires Plus, and then he had his own company selling tires internationally. And extremely interesting guy, and so smart. And then the third guy is a friend of mine. He's in his 80s now, but he's sharp as a tack. His name is Colonel Roger Letting. He used to be head of the State Patrol in Minnesota. And I was on a couple different boards with him, but I still see him and talk to him. And he has, I think, an interesting background, very interesting in what he accomplished in his life. And he's one of the funniest people you've ever met. So I'm sure when you interview him, he'll tell you some jokes.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. Thank you for sharing the story. We might end up having to do a second one, but I really appreciate it. And I'm sure the listeners will find it interesting, but if no one else does, I really found that fascinating. So thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us on Minnesota Stories. If you like what you hear, please subscribe. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And if there's anybody you'd like to hear from, let us know. We would love to hear their Minnesota story as well.